This is the Fourth Estate on RCR Reality Check Radio.
Good afternoon. You're with Reality Check Radio on this windy, cloudy, rainy November the 15th, 2024. I'm your host, Marty Gibson, and this is the Fourth Estate, a show where we look at the goings-on and increasingly the goings-under of mainstream media. And increasingly, we also survey the green shoots of the independent media outlets and operators who are rising to fill the space, and the King Canute moves to try and turn the tide with tax. This week, we're going to take a look at job losses, ratings, the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill, the Treaty Principles Bill, the Hikoi, fact-checking, lying and boycotting in the media, and more. Joining me to survey this, two guests, and looking at him now, he has a healthy ruddiness about him. He's not pale. He is a former judge and mastermind winner and an expert on the emerging field of internet law. He's not stale, but he is male. David Harvey, welcome.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for that welcome and that introduction. I don't know what it is about the colour. It must be the settings on the little light source that I have, but hey, there it is.
Yeah, you maybe... I don't know. It seems to trigger some people, but I think it looks good. Our other guest for the first time on the Fourth Estate is a former journalist, an award-winning public relations practitioner, and a voice of conservative politics. And he writes at Deprogrammed Delusions on Substack. Welcome, Glenn Inwood.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to it. All right, well, let's crack into it. We've got a bit to cover off. I guess, first of all, this is from the Surveying the Wreckage Department. Publisher NZME is proposing to close 14 community newspapers with the loss of about 30 jobs, which is a body blow for local news in many New Zealand regions, and the latest bombshell in a year of major media cuts and closures, and the titles all in the North Island are no longer profitable in the face of a changing media landscape and rising costs, NZME said. So this is from the New Zealand Herald Media Insider yesterday. So these will include mastheads such as the Te Awamutu Courier, whose origins stretch back more than 100 years, as well as 13 other titles, and 30 in total. So I started my career as a journalist at the Gisborne Herald back around 2007, when it was still owned by the Muir family, and I worked there for 5 years. And after years of living overseas, it was a marvelous way to get to know the Tairawhiti region better. And I met so many interesting people who took their participation in that first draft of history really seriously. So I have a tremendous affection for these small papers, and it's a shame to see them go, but in many ways, their dependency on advertising money from councils, iwi, DHBs, and ultimately Jacinda Ardern seem to compromise their objectivity and ability to hold those entities to account in the way a healthy society needs. And it reminds me of that adage, there are but two classes of people in the world, those who have done something that want their names kept out of the paper, and those who haven't done anything worth printing and want their names put in. And also, whatever a patron desires to get published as advertising, whatever he wants to keep out of the paper is news. Do you think there are going to be titles emerging to replace these, or what's going to happen in this space? Because people still like paper.
Paper. Well, yeah. That's the issue, isn't it, Marty? Because everything's going digital these days, and although I loathe the idea of reading my newspaper on the phone, and I prefer it if I've got to do it digitally on an iPad or something like that, digital delivery is going to be the way of the future, and that's a fact. In the same way that the printing press created a revolution as far as communications were concerned in the written space, digital has now created yet another revolution, indeed a paradigmatic change, in terms of the communication space generally. I would like to think that there will be other hard copy or kinetic platforms that will emerge as a result of all of this. What did fascinate me about the Media Insider comment was that Shane Currie didn't hesitate to link the collapse of these titles with the Fair Digital News bargaining bill and the fact that it didn't go for its second reading before the House on Thursday, as it was scheduled to do. I don't believe that the failure to implement or give the second reading of that particular bill had anything to do with the collapse of these titles. I think the decisions had been made about those titles some considerable length of time ago, and the Fair Digital News bargaining bill, even if it was enacted, would not have saved them at all. So I think it was opportunistic, shall we say, from the part of Mr. Currie to adopt that particular stance.
Glenn, you're very active in local body politics now with your organisation for a Greater Wellington, I think. Is that the name of it? Sorry?
It's called Better Wellington.
Better Wellington. Beg your pardon.
A group of us in Wellington put it together, yeah.
Yeah, in order to get an informed voting public, you really need high-quality local news, don't you? What are your thoughts on this?
My thoughts on this is that the NZME move is certainly reflective of the times. And I started out at the Christchurch Star when it was owned by the Horton family back in the early 90s, and then have also done some work on community newspapers over those years. But to be honest, I really don't think we should mourn the loss of them. They were cash cows in those days where it was the only form of advertising you had before the internet took off. And they were making a lot of money, and that's why you saw the proliferation of them around the country. But some entrepreneurs might jump in and find they can turn a profit and look to buy up some of those mastheads. But to be honest, those days of these community newspapers are gone. And I know how difficult it is to keep a community newspaper going, because I started one in the early 1990s in Dunedin, and it's extremely difficult to sustain a level of operational revenue.
Rather than blaming the Fair Digital News bargaining bill, they could probably more accurately sheet the blame home to Trade Me, couldn't they? Because that's part of it,
and everything's moved on, and you have to question whether these days they're even a vehicle for the local parish pump type news. And they're just not how people get information these days. They're whether they're going, you know, or even advertising, whether it's worth a bang for your buck. It's just the reality. Local groups communicate with their bases now via other means than a community newspaper, whether it's social media sites or whether it's an email database and regular newsletters. So I'm certainly not one to champion the MSM, but I say good on them. Time to cut loose the dead weight and tell it like it is. If they made money, they'd still exist.
Well, speaking of that, we've got the latest 6 p.m. TV news ratings out over the past week, and they're not looking that good either. Particularly among young people, it's as if all these stories are tying together, isn't it? We've got the election of Trump, which occurred largely through non-traditional media, and the failure of traditional media to have the effect that they might have had in previous years. Just going through, they're now consistently three news bulletin. Are now consistently below 200,000, whereas TVNZ tends to fluctuate more wildly, but generally stays above 500,000 viewers, with highs around the mid 600 mark. But the most, this is again from the Media Insider, the most noticeable trend has been the drop in the 25 to 54 age bracket for Three News, the group of viewers that advertisers are particularly keen to target. I guess the concern with these companies must be that there's a threshold beyond which the drop might become precipitous, and the marginal, well, it's they're losing money, obviously, but the marginal might become disastrous. What do you think? How long do you think we're going to have television? Well, terrestrial.
Well, look, let me jump in on that one first of all, because my view is I haven't watched TVNZ News or TV3 News at 6 o'clock for a long time, Marty, because I get my news elsewhere. But why would you watch it? Why would you watch it if you're in your mid-20s? Why would you bother? To be frank, if you're at home watching the 6 p.m. news and you're in your mid-20s, then I say bless you and good luck, you know?
You say what? Sorry?
Bless you. Good luck.
Yeah.
You know, if you get your news from Radio New Zealand in the morning and your and TVNZ or Stuff 6 p.m. news in the evening, then quite frankly, you really only have yourself to blame. There is absolutely no way you can be reliably informed if that's your media diet. Full transparency on that one. You know, Radio New Zealand, TVNZ need to be sold off by the government. Let someone pick it up for a song and see if they can make a go of it. But the days of state-owned, taxpayer-funded media really needs to be knocked on the head. And that goes for Māori TV. And I know that a lot of Māori Party supporters might get their knickers in a twist with what I'm about to say and cry victim, and that the Crown has a duty to protect the language and an obligation on that under the treaty. But there are plenty of people in New Zealand who I think, you know, they are learning the Māori language. I encourage that enormously. But do I want my hard-earned tax money going towards these institutions? No, I don't. And we just don't have people in Parliament to take that leadership, is my view. I think no wonder that generation is moving away from TV. My sons are in their early 20s. They get their information elsewhere. They don't watch TV.
How about you, David? Are you rushing?
Likewise, Marty. I mean, okay. This is time for Mea Maxima Culpa confession. my wife and I regularly watch 6 o'clock news, TVNZ, in the evening, probably the first 15 minutes of it before we go to dinner. We then switch the television set off. So it's sort of, you know, it isn't a serious thing. I have a direct link to the NZ Herald on my Google Chrome. I don't go via Google News or Facebook News or anything like that, like the majority of people do. So in those respects, I'm a sort of hardcore mainstream media consumer. I don't go for Stuff because I think the website stinks, but that's a matter of design rather than content. But my son, who is just turned 39, as Glenn said, gets his news elsewhere, and from a variety of sources, including some that I didn't know about, but which I'm finding out about, like The Wire, for example, more of my friends. And of my age group, I might say, are turning to, and there'll be cheers in the background for this one, RCR, and also for the platform. Because these other outlets are delivering it like it should be delivered and are being straight up about it. But I agree with Glenn. I think the time for state media has gone. The state has been involved in media from day one with licenses and all the rest of that type of thing. And the reason for that is that the state wanted to control the message. It wasn't an accident that state control of NZBC, as I think it were, NZBS, was under the Labor government. Of course they wanted to maintain control, and they didn't like the idea of foreign ownership when foreign ownership was proposed in the 1960s when Lord Thompson wanted to come in. So I think the time has passed. I think that they're dead wood and time to move on. We're in a new communications paradigm now, in case anybody hadn't noticed. So perhaps mainstream media ought to recognize that right across the board, not only radio and TV, but newspapers and all other forms of news communication as well. It is a new paradigm. One person really understood how to use the new paradigm, and that was Trump. And that's one of the reasons why he got elected.
You know, Dave, it should still be called NZBS. But Marty, you and I have had this discussion. You know, it takes a lot of work for people to remain to be informed. But you cannot be informed if RNZ and TVNZ are your only forms of news. You're going to wake up in the morning after the US election and wonder, how the hell did Donald Trump get there? Where a lot of people who were following this on via other means, via X or via podcasts or via, as David said, The Wire or other global media, you'd know the where it was all heading. And but I can understand how some people woke up in New Zealand and thought, wow, this is interesting. How did we get here? Because they wouldn't have been informed via those properly, I don't believe.
I haven't caught the morning news this morning, but Alex Jones got taken off air this morning because he was forced into bankruptcy by, I think they were looking at fining him $1 trillion or something. It was a figure that you'd put your pinky to your lips when you were saying. And I think what we're dealing with is a fading tale of people who do believe their televisions and radios. Now, if there was a survey done of this, and the people who are most likely to believe their television are ladies who vote Labour, followed by national voters of both sexes. But it is a shrinking group. But their presence does make our pursuit of health, happiness, and harmony far harder than it needs to be, because we've been set against each other in a whole series of zero-sum games where we might rather be more the sum of our parts, more than the sum of our parts, sorry. And I think those people have allowed a weight of numbers that has provided politicians with the ability to progress with these globalist plans that are not at all in our interest.
And
when you're talking to those people, the vibe I get from them is, surely if this were a thing, Paddy Gow would have said something about it. As the consumer of media, it's easy to labor under the illusion that you are the customer. You aren't. You're part of the product. The real customers are the folks who print the money, who control the private equity firms, the ones that own the corporations that do the advertising. They're the customer. And what they want...
The medium is the message. Is much perfect.
Yeah, what they want is not what you want. In fact, in many cases, it's what the majority of people really don't want.
Yeah.
But we're seeing this King Canute like effort that I alluded to in the introduction to maintain that status quo with those media companies seeing the precious and wants it. David, this is, as I often say, this is very much your wheelhouse with the digital news bargaining bill, but I understand that's up in the air now, is it?
It is. It was meant to be given a second reading, which would have been unfortunate, earlier this week. And it was taken off the order paper. And there is further work that needs to be done. Now, of course, mainstream media has been very, very critical in the past of conspiracy theorists and all sorts of things like that. But they've embarked upon their own little conspiracy theory here by suggesting that Google got to the minister. And in fact, Google has been engaged in a bit of bullying. That is a load of rubbish. Google is a business like any other. And I don't think it wields so much power that it's going to intimidate Goldsmith. And I don't suppose that Luxon would even understand what they were saying if they said it to him. But be that as it may, the bill isn't going to go ahead for whatever reason. But the interesting fact that comes out of all of this is that Media Insider ran a story about it and brought out the usual sort of tropes about Google bullying and so on and so forth. What Google and Facebook and the various others have said is, if the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill compels us to go to the bargaining table to pay for linking to content on mainstream media, we're not going to do that anymore. That's not going to be part of our business model. Well, that's fine. That's a business decision that they're making. Now, the fact of the matter is that if Google and Facebook were to do that, it would become very, very difficult for New Zealanders to get their news content. And what happened was that there was a survey that was commissioned not so long ago which said, well, what would you, how would you feel if news, New Zealand news stories were unavailable through search engines? 32% of the respondents to that survey said they would be very annoyed. 33% said they would be somewhat annoyed. So there was a 55% annoyance factor on the part of respondents if they couldn't use Google to get their news. 75.
That's a great categorisation, isn't it? The Kiwis are moving from being a bit upset to being quite cross.
Yeah, and it's all because Trump got elected, I guess. But 75% of those surveyed were under 40. Now that's not surprising because that cohort comprises the digital natives who live a significant part of their lives in the digital space. So that's not strange. 65% of those surveyed who were very, very upset or annoyed were Aucklanders. 57 were Wellingtonians, but I suppose since they make the news, that might explain that. 96% of Te Pāti Māori voters registered that they would be somewhat or very annoyed with news unavailability via the platforms. 70% of the Greens, Labour at 69%, even 62% of the National voters would be annoyed or somewhat annoyed at the unavailability of platform-based news access. So that's a sort of unintended consequence, if you like. You're going to make a whole lot of people very, very unhappy as a result of a business decision by Google and Facebook. And to proceed with the bill, I think, would be very, very unwise because it will just result in a further form of dissatisfaction on the part of the populace. And I would suggest that that particular survey gives the government the opportunity to read the room, which they haven't done very well in the past, and which they aren't doing very well with the Treaty Principles Bill either, but that's another story. But yeah, that seems to be the situation with the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill. I believe that copyright law is the place where this particular difficulty lies. That's where it should live, and nobody could argue with that.
How are you getting some traction on that, David, or are you still very much a voice in the wilderness? The lone voice of reason on this.
I'm getting some support from some readers of my material on Substack because I've been blasting out this particular message for some time. And I am going to be putting forward my copyright proposals to the minister. Unfortunately, of course, now he's got a bit of breathing space so he can think about it, and we'll see where that goes. I think people understand that it's a stupid proposal, but I don't think that they're that invested in it until they start to realise that this is going to have downstream consequences for them in terms of the availability of their news via the platforms. Because the fact of the matter is, and we've known this since 2013, 2014, most people access their news digitally via the platforms like Facebook and Google. They don't, like I do, have a little Herald app on their phone or on their desktop.
Yeah. Well, I subscribed to the Herald digitally last week, and it's going to save me a stack of money because I have to, the course of this, I have to buy papers every day and have a big pile of them, and it's probably easier for me to go digital. Glenn, where are you on the spectrum of a bit upset to quite cross?
I think David has really summed it up the best. I'm not sure there's much more I can add to it. And he's absolutely correct. We live in a digital world. The media lives in a digital world, and they embrace it. And they should be fighting for their existence and charging readers for quality content. And try to make it in the world today alongside Google and alongside Facebook and alongside all those other global behemoths. Traditional media, such as the favourites of the Liberals, which would be what, The Guardian and The New York Times, I don't read them myself, but they survive by charging content. Then there's others like The Wall Street Journal, like The Australian, like The Daily Telegraph in the UK, and they also survive with both a printed, physical printed edition and an increasingly popular digital version that has global reach. And I don't want to be any more cynical than I would normally, because I'm really trying to understand alternative points of view on this. But to be frank, the New Zealand media cannot have it both ways. If they like this new world, They want to embrace the digital technology. Yes, there are areas around increased government surveillance in a digital world that requires careful consideration, but for the media, on the one hand, to enjoy the benefits that a digital world brings them, such as increased reach, greater immediacy of their content, despite what I would call slovenly and badly edited material, but to decry the fact that these online organizations, these huge social media companies, are making money from online content is hypocritical. Let me just give you one example. The media take content from people on X and use it in their articles. They quote X, such and such said this on X, or Trump announced this on his Truth Social. Or such and such announced something on Instagram, yada, yada, yada. And yet they have the audacity to say these companies are making too much money from sharing content from New Zealand mainstream media, and they want a slice of their pie. If they were any good, there would be a market for what they are selling. There isn't. But there is for those other newspapers and traditional media overseas that are actually providing intelligent, authoritative discussions and reporting that we used to have in New Zealand. The fact that our education system, our pay rates of journalists have given us the media that we have in this country, that's a fact, and that might be a significant factor on why mainstream media is finding it difficult to survive without taxpayer intervention. Just saying.
Yeah, that's such a good point.
I could come in on that just for one moment, because the fact of it is that Google News does not actually use the content from mainstream media. They link to it. They link to it. Now, mainstream media actually cut and paste from X. So they're engaged in the broadest sense, copyright infringement, the very thing that they're complaining that Google is doing, that Google is not, in fact, doing. Google is linking. And, you know, to say that they're using our content, rubbish.
The fact people don't want to pay for stuff has nothing to do with Google or Facebook. It has to do with the quality of their content.
Yeah, and it's quite jarring sitting watching the news. And if I am watching the news, and as I said, I have to consume it in the course of what I do at RCR, which tends to be media related, but I do it with my phone in my hand reading X. And so it just really rubs it in, because I'm getting terribly poor quality information from the TV and excellent information from X. I mean, I can watch Jeffrey Sachs, you know, outline in exquisite detail the origins of the Ukrainian conflict and how a lot of the blame can be sheeted home to the US as the Greeks have moved toward Russia. And then I've got Simon Dallow on One News saying he's only just been elected, but Donald Trump is already meddling in Ukraine, as if trying to intervene in a war that's already cost a million lives is some nefarious thing. It's very odd. And in your Tale of Two Bills article, you pointed out that this is related to the Treaty Principles Bill as well, which we'll move to next. Both bills are going to require our lawmakers to read the room and get a sense of what the nation wants. The only problem is that the loudest voices in the room are not representative of the majority. And so that's, the case for the media. And we can move now, Glenn, to the Treaty Principles Bill. And you, I know, watched with interest the contrast and treatment of the two. And it's been interesting seeing the media coverage of the hikoi, or rather the motorcar hoi, because they're not walking. But it calls to mind those breathless newsreels detailing the Allies liberating Europe, doesn't it? Although in this case, they're cheering on an ethno-nationalist movement that seeks to block any discussion of the potential injustice from race-based laws. Glenn, we don't hear much from Māori like you, who might not be quite so all in on the idea of a separate government for those with Māori whakapapa. What are your thoughts on the coverage? And we'll move to the hikoi after that.
Well, the issue that I have with the media is they're continuing to describe the bill as being divisive. a bill can't be divisive. What's divisive is the way people are responding to the bill. Parliament is about where ideas can be raised and debated. It's a contest of ideas. But what we are seeing and what we have seen with this hīkoi is the immediate escalation of the discussion by the Māori Party in conjunction with the Green Party. Now, I have, I'm not sure where David stands on it, but I don't believe that this act is required. I don't support it, but I don't support it for the reasons that either the National Party doesn't support it or the Māori Party don't support it. In fact, I'm surprised that the Māori Party don't support it because, you know, the treaty settlement process is a grift that keeps on grifting, and I'm surprised that they don't want this these principles put in. The only way that I think ACT's treaty principles bill could ever work is if it's entrenched in legislation and requires something like a 75% majority in Parliament to change it in the future, because be careful what you wish for, because you might just get it. Just because you're in power now doesn't mean you'll be in power tomorrow. And if ACT is successful in this passing, it will just be a simple piece of legislation that requires a majority in Parliament to change it. We are living through a period of identity politics. And while it's been happening for years, it has accelerated since 2020 in the response to COVID. And political positions have shifted. Before long, our country takes a serious look at where it is, we really need to, and what it wants to achieve in the future. Because we will see a time when the Green Party, the Māori Party, and the Labour Party make up the majority in Parliament. And God help us when that happens, because there will be a choice for them. It will be either repeal that legislation if it ever went through, which it isn't going to go through. Let's get that straight. It's not going to go any further than first reading. But they will have a choice of repealing that legislation or expanding it to include their principles and what they consider the treaty to be. And gentlemen, believe you me, that would be far worse than what we have now. So that's the first reason I don't support this bill. It's pure political pragmatism. The second reason is that we need to move on from this victimhood mentality that pervades our communities. It's pervasive throughout our educational institutions, our legal institutions, our bureaucracies, and it has led to this divisive separatist agenda amongst Māori, and it's a drunken reverie since the early 1990s when the treaty settlements began, when Doug Graham took to the road with a fiscal envelope to settle Treaty of Waitangi breaches. And those settlements have allowed for iwi to become, or some iwi to become, economic powerhouses. And they've grown their wealth and they can take care of their people who whakapapa to that iwi. But it's become a noose around the country's back and neck, and it has resulted in a ridiculous, comical notions that, for example, stripping the Māori Health Authority is a breach of the treaty. No, it isn't. But for many people, the treaty settlement process, as I said earlier, is a grift that keeps on grifting, and it has to come to an end.
David?
Yeah, I agree with Glenn's second view, but he and I part company on whether or not the bill's a good idea, because what we've got to remember is that the bill sets out a set of principles, and it proposes that at the end of the day, if it is enacted, there should be a referendum, which means that the people will decide on whether or not these are going to be the principles of that guide the courts and various others in the application of the Treaty of Waitangi. Now, the problem is there, and this is one of the reasons why Te Pāti Māori and the various others are upset about it, is that a recent survey that was carried out by Courier concluded that some two-thirds of the population actually support the bill going through to a referendum. Now, the thing is that if that two-thirds was to manifest itself in a vote, you would have a situation similar to Australia where the no vote won. And the proposals would become law. And that is what Te Pāti Māori and the treaty grifters and so on and so forth are really afraid of. So that's the long game. Interestingly enough, I heard about that survey on the radio, on Radio New Zealand yesterday, and it was pointed out that the survey was done by Courier. And then what happened was that the announcer began to criticize the survey, not on the basis of how it was conducted or anything like that, but that Courier is not a part of the official survey organization or whatever it is. So immediately they were sort of trying to sideline 2/3 of the population of New Zealand. But looking at the bill itself, just very, very simply, Principle 1 confirms the executive and parliament have the power to govern New Zealand. So it's in the interests of everybody, not just the majority, but everybody. And it's according to the rule of law and for the maintenance of a free and democratic society. So that confirms the governmental structure of New Zealand of what could be termed a liberal democracy. So if that principle were to state something that disenfranchised a large section of the community or provided for rule by an unelected executive, or that the rule of law was subservient to the will of the Prime Minister, we might have something to argue about, but we don't. Principle one would be well recognised by people like John Locke, Thomas Jefferson, John Stuart Mill, the Western Enlightenment philosophers. But if the protesters are opposed to the bill, then they must be opposed to the concept of government under the rule of law. They must be opposed to the concept of government in the best interests of everyone. In short, they're opposed to democratic government. That's the ultimate destination that the logic leads you to. As far as Principle 3 is concerned, you've got equality before the law without discrimination, equal protection of the law, and equal enjoyment of fundamental human rights. So are the protesters against this? By saying that we shouldn't have this bill, they must be. So we have a societal structure, they would argue, that favours discrimination, doesn't allow equal protection and the benefit of the law, and they'd reject the proposition that there cannot be unequal enjoyment of fundamental human rights. Principle 2 actually preserves the treaty reparation principle. And there is no doubt that reparation must be granted in some cases because wrongs were done. But that's a historical process. It isn't an ongoing one where, there is a new invention that was never contemplated in 1840, and therefore iwi should have a share. The historical process of remedy of breaches of the treaty remains in place under Section 2. And importantly, nothing in the bill is set out to destroy the Treaty of Waitangi. It stays in place. So
that's been one of the worst things about the coverage.
What's not to like?
The fact that there's been so little correction when people have consistently said they're seeking to abolish the treaty. And there are so many young Māori who believe that.
Well, they haven't read the bill. It's not even,
David, that they haven't read the bill. What it is that the treaty cannot be abolished. It is a part of history. Right.
No, well, it won't be abolished, not by this bill anyway. I look upon it as an interesting historical artifact, and it's time. I would think that it's probably time for us to move on. But
We are here where we are as a country.
Yeah,
and we have spent the last 30 years working through a settlement process to remedy breaches of the treaty from 1840 onwards. But the point has come where that needs to be finished. The Waitangi Tribunal needs to be wound up by the end of next year, yep. And we need to move on together as a country. But unfortunately, and I think you're right when you refer to the rule of law, the Māori Party and the Green Party, I don't believe, have a very strong... Well, I think they would subvert the rule of law to achieve their goals, and we're seeing that on a daily basis, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was quite a thing in Parliament, wasn't it, yesterday with Gerry Brownlee having to adjourn for the afternoon and the vigorous haka in front of David Seymour. My concern is that.
Sound and fury signifying nothing, Martin. Yeah. Politics par excellence.
Yeah, we need to have the discussion. And my concern, even for the Māori Party, is this is going to really put a lot of non-Māori off engaging in it. And I think they're going to find the vote is going to very much swing against them as a result. It's surprising to me that Luxon is, well, it's not that surprising that he's so limp on the whole thing. I saw the interview with him where he said, my view is very simple. We've had 184 years of grappling with the treaty and what it means for New Zealand. I think it's made us a better country, but it's simplistic to negate that with a stroke of a pen. It's not the way forward. Is he reading the room here?
No. You know, that's his problem.
I've just had a look on X, and there was a Kiwi guy who put up one of the videos about, you know, showing what occurred in Parliament yesterday from a very good angle. And it's had 4 million views. You know, that is where it's going in the world. You know, it has just completely gone viral across the globe.
Yeah.
This is how the New Zealand government works.
Yeah. It's great maybe as an introduction where you can get the overflowing feeling out and get down to brass tacks, but we never seem to get down to brass tacks.
I always thought those rugby huckers were particularly good when the All Blacks would line up and go through the whole thing and the other side would actually start to advance on them. And I thought, that's what it takes. That's what it's all about. You want a challenge? We're here. We're going to pick it up.
I guess that's what I'm trying to say. It doesn't necessarily bring up the better angels of our nature if it's just incessant. And I think there is, you know, there have been a few, I mean, the Irish rugby player who, I think was he Irish or was he in the Lions, you know, said that he was, that the haka was being a bit overdone. I found the throat slitting gesture, you know, maybe took it a little too far in a sporting context, but I don't know. I think a lot of people, you can look at a graph of perpetrators of violent offences in New Zealand, and I saw one that was widely circulated from 2023, and yeah, Māori are disproportionately, I think the figure was per 100,000, and this was acts intended to cause injury by ethnicity. The year to March 2023, Māori were 954 per 100,000 people, whereas Europeans are 133, Asians are 30, Indians are 212, Pacifica 410. And you know, then there's the statistics around the harm to children. I think it puts those displays in context in Parliament. And I think I'm concerned that, I don't know, it'd be good to walk back from that and get into, as I said, get down to brass tacks and be free to have a discussion rather than shutting it down with intimidation.
You know, Marty, you brought it up earlier about the difference that the media is taking with this hikoi versus, and you made reference to it, although you didn't say it, to the 2022 anti-mandate convoy that left from the same place at Cape Reinga and came to Wellington. And the media have taken diametrically opposite views on each one. This hikoi is getting its publicity from mainstream media. They are giving it major coverage all the way, and yet they are fueling a lot of the support for it. You know, we'll see how many people end up in Wellington next week. But
Particularly given it is through and through a Te Pāti Māori initiative, isn't it? It's It's
100%
organised by people with familial links to Te Pāti Māori, and it's being treated like a grassroots organisation. Which the hikoi for the anti-mandate protests genuinely were, and they were switching off cameras, underrepresenting numbers, blowing them out. It's very interesting.
Yeah, my concern is that the hikoi that's heading towards Wellington now is acting under a misapprehension about what everything what it's all about. And it really is more of a protest against this coalition government than it is actually about the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi Bill, yeah. Which is really only it's really only been the torch really that lit the flame, but it's more about the government.
Mm. Well, you know, in an olive branch that I often extend to Māori is to say, look, I would triple the Treaty of Waitangi settlements and pull New Zealand out of the Paris Climate Accord.
Yeah.
Because I think our liabilities in there are currently $30 billion. They're heading for $70 billion. Graph it, that's where they're heading. Yeah. That's what a government department said. All the solutions are things which aren't there yet. You know, these ridiculous things of mRNA treatments for cows' gut bacteria so they make less methane. All of this utter ridiculousness. And $70 billion was roughly 30 times the total treaty settlements. And we've torn ourselves to shreds over that $3 billion or $3.5 billion or whatever it is. And yet this tremendous liability on the basis of pretty shaky science that we're not allowed to debate, that the silence on that by contrast is incredible, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. And the narrative around all of that, the climate stuff, you know, that will start to change. And I think you'll see that with the Trump administration, and we'll see how that pans out. But, yeah, I agree with you.
Exciting times. Now, after the general disorder we've seen in Parliament this week, it seems odd that newsroom journalist Aaron Smale was barred from the abuse apology at Parliament, although he was subsequently allowed in. And for those of you unfamiliar with this, Aaron Smale covered the abuse of children and others in state institutions for about 8 years, and that included the Crown's legal strategy to exhaust survivors legally to save money and reputations. David, why did they choose to do this, do you think?
Well, I came across Aaron Smale by accident, and I was led to five articles that he wrote, very much in depth, very investigative, very, very thorough indeed. And they, in fact, were quite shocking that what had actually taken place was horrifying. And what, in fact, the government did over a number of years was outrageous in terms of trying to cover things up or trying to avoid liability or whatever. And one of the targets of Smale's investigative journalism was our Solicitor General, Erna Jagosi, who recently came out with some Crown prosecution guidelines, which she very hurriedly had to withdraw, thank goodness, because they were outrageous. And she had masterminded and led the Crown strategy on lawfare, if you like, exhaustion by litigation. Now, one of the inferences, I think, that was clear from Smale's articles was that Jagosi should be called to account. And that was a pretty serious thing to say about a Solicitor General, but there it is. Now, I think that because of the hard questions that Smale had asked, and because of some of the things that he had revealed, it was considered that he could be a disruptive force. And I'm speaking, if I was advocating for the government, he might be a disruptive force at an apology ceremony that was going to be given to the victims of this horrifying abuse. Now, that, of course, was a conclusion that wasn't available, in my view. The one guy who had really done a tremendous amount of work was excluded from the meeting that was going to try and bring this whole thing together. And it was just outrageous. And the only reason that I can think is that they wanted to shut him down. And then when there was an outburst against his banning, if it were, or his lack of accreditation, they had to back down, and they backed down rather quickly. And the fact that they had to back down makes it even more significant that what they had done in the first place was stupid, And, you know, you don't try to silence a critic. You engage with them, for heaven's sake.
It's another bit of tin ear, isn't it? The lawyer who has pursued the justice for those survivors, Sonia Cooper, had some very acerbic remarks on it, which I thought were very good. And she, you know, was very complimentary about what Smale had done in exposing the lives and cover-ups by the Crown. Should mean he has a front row invite to the apology. And she said, in my view, this decision is just another small example of the Crown dodging responsibility and its ingrained habit of avoiding accountability. What is it that the Prime Minister and his people are really uncomfortable about? What do you think they're uncomfortable about, Glenn?
Look, I'm not familiar with that particular topic, but just going back to Aaron Smale there and what David was saying, I agree absolutely entirely with what David's analysis is, and I really don't have much more to add on that. You can't, you know, they backed down very quickly. Gerry Brownlee very quickly moved changed the ruling, and that was the right outcome. So yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't help the mutterings that were very much around the States about, you know, child trafficking and other things like that, and the use of, and as we've seen with the P. Diddy case, as we saw with Jimmy Savile, Mark Dutroux in Belgium, you know, they were held up as being pedophiles, but they were procurers as much as anything. Is, I mean, you know, I don't want to get all paranoid, David, but is there a link between the abuse of these children and the use of blackmail to keep people in line?
Oh, I wouldn't go that far. But I think the whole thing can be exemplified by the recent scandal that's taken place in the UK, where there was a terrible child abuser who was associated with the Anglican Church. Now, the Archbishop of Canterbury knew about that, and he knew about it as far back as, I think it was 2013, and he did what? He did nothing. Now, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Archbishop Welby, has now resigned as Archbishop of Canterbury, and jolly good too, because what he did was a cover-up. And this is where the problem lies. People don't want to admit liability for this sort of thing. People want to deny that it happens because they don't want to have to confront the reality of it. Within the micro context, I have sat on cases of horrific child abuse where family members and the like have turned a blind eye to what was going on because they didn't want to know, or because they wanted to cover it up. They didn't want the authorities to be involved, or rangatamariki, or something like that. And in the wider context, as far as state care is concerned, the state doesn't want to admit liability because if it does, then it's going to have to put its hand in its pocket and make compensation. Well, now it has to because of the long-term cover-up that has taken place here. And it's the cover-up that's the problem, Marty. The act itself, of course, is horrifying, but the cover-up is even worse.
And that's right.
I mean, we haven't learned the lesson from Nixon, really?
Well, the other problem that's emerging is that a lot of the people who were the victims of this abuse in state care went on as hurt people often do to hurt others, and often joined gangs. So is the government nervous about the optics of paying compensation to gang members?
Probably. But
how might they get around that?
I think they should put up and shut up, frankly. The fact of the matter is a person has been damaged. Now, it may be as a result of that damage they have pursued a certain course. You know, their life has followed a particular path. But the fact of the matter is that there has been damage, there has been a wrong done, and there should be compensation. Doesn't matter that they were a gang member, doesn't matter that they weren't. The fact of the matter is that they were wronged, and there's the issue. And if we're going to subscribe to the rule of law,
that's right,
then we should recognize that and do something about it instead of trying to cover it up or trying to avoid liability.
That's right. And if you subscribe to the principle that we're all equal you know, under the law, then, you know, it doesn't matter if somebody's a gang member or what. If they're a gang member and committing crimes, they should be, you know, dealt with on those that basis. But if they suffered an abuse and at the hands of the state, and that's been proved, and then the state needs to pay.
I guess we could wrap the next three topics that we had, because we're up against time. You could summarize it by saying the mainstream media is reacting to Trump. And this is in the case of news guards collecting RFK health claims for debunking. That's going to be interesting to see what is going to happen as he reveals that and they have to report on it, where they've been ignoring it. Washington Post subscribers threw a temper tantrum and a tidal wave of cancellations after Jeff Bezos decided to block an endorsement of Vice President Kamala Harris for president. And lastly, we're seeing The Guardian throwing its toys and quitting X. Now, those are all related to those green shoots of new media and old media confronting them, I guess, one at a time to close. What are we going to see, and what changes is that going to bring about? Glenn, what are your thoughts on?
Look, the mainstream media is going through an entire new, you know, a huge period of change. The fact that The Guardian is no longer on X, I mean, who cares? You know, the paper is, you know, that's up to them. And it's the same when Stuff said that they weren't going to subscribe to X anymore. The WAPO story, though, was very interesting, and I think that is demonstrative of how mainstream, the trust in mainstream media has fallen. And what I'm referring to is the story that came out last week, or earlier this week, I forget when, that the Washington Post claimed Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin had a conversation. And they detailed that conversation from an anonymous source in the US federal government, and that they discussed the surrender or the capitulation of Ukraine, the fact that Russia would get some of that territory, blah, 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 and how it would help end the war. A day later, Dmitry Peskov from the Kremlin denied that phone call had ever taken place, that it was fake news, and that at the time, President Putin was actually giving a speech when he was supposedly speaking to Donald Trump. And then a day later, Donald Trump releases a list of global leaders who have called him since the election, and Putin wasn't on the list. So no wonder people beginning have no faith or trust in mainstream media when they release rubbish like that. Now, it was either somebody making it up at the Washington Post or some of the neocons causing trouble, and like the CIA or someone like that, calling the Washington Post and making something up. Either way, it's not a good look, and they deserve everything they get. And that is why people are turning to other media sources to get their information. So that's what we're seeing. It's just a slow unraveling of that of mainstream media, and may it continue.
What do you think, David?
Well, what really interested me, although I wasn't surprised, was that in addition to The Guardian spitting the dummy as far as Twitter was, or X is concerned, was the fact that they put out a call for funds so that they could hold Donald Trump to account. Now, I mean, you'd expect that from The Guardian, but it was very, very blatant. But like Glenn, I see all of this as part of the demise of mainstream media. I actually thought that Bezos was adopting a very, very principled position in saying, you know, we'll go with the outcome. We'll go with the result. We're not going to back any particular horse in this race. We'll go with the outcome. And in that respect, you know, the Washington Post, although slightly left of center though it might be, as far as its owner was concerned, was being neutral. The thing is that for whatever reason, and I think it has a lot to do with what journalists are being taught at journalism school these days, and thank goodness I didn't go to it, is that media is left-wing, and people are recognising that, and they're migrating away from it because it doesn't reflect their particular point of view. It doesn't appeal to them. And for any evidence of that, ask the 75 million who voted for Trump.
Well, I think with the Trump derangement syndrome arcing up as he approaches inauguration, it's the mainstream media is probably going to become even more unbearable to watch.
Yep.
not only in mainstream media, you know, there was that. I saw the Free Speech Union come out the other day with Trump derangement syndrome, saying Trump was against censorship, Trump was against free speech. I mean, you can you know a lobby group that that's pandering to its base when it comes out with stuff like that.
I'm a member of the Free Speech Union, Glenn. Careful.
Well, I'm not. I'm just telling you what they've said.
I know what they said, and they based it on a particular statement. And they're free speech. They're entitled to their point of view.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And we're entitled to say it's wrong, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I don't agree with it, but there it is.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great place to leave it. Thanks very much for joining us this morning, Glenn and David. We'll look forward to having you on again, and have a great weekend.
Thank you very much, Marty. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Marty. It's been most enjoyable.
Thanks very much. Goodbye.
You've been listening to The Fourth Estate right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.